Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today. In this week's episode, I explore political downfalls. We see it time and again. The very personality traits such as risk-taking, ambition, attention-seeking, or just plain competitiveness can be the very elements that can bring down a successful person. So as Boris Johnson takes his final Prime Minister's questions, I reflect on Boris's career and explore whether the very traits that mobilised his success also led to his being removed from office by his own party. To help me, I'm delighted to welcome the Chief Political Commentator for The Independent and Visiting Professor at King's College London, John Rentall. Hello, John.
Hello, Lucy.
Welcome to my couch. As I say, although of course it's not you on the couch, it's very much
Thank
Boris.
Goodness for that.
That could be like a whole 2-hour episode. You have recently written about how Boris Johnson is paying the price for people's perceptions of him, the electorate's perceptions of him that were once a great strength. So what do you think were those personality traits of Boris that made the Conservative Party turn to him in the first place?
Well, you just listed some of them in your introduction, risk-taking, intense competitiveness and the rest of it. But in particular, in Boris Johnson's case, he's perceived as a rule breaker, as someone who isn't bound by the norm, as someone who can get things done just by sheer bull-headed determination. And that's how he got Brexit done. That's how he got the election done. Which allowed him to get Brexit done. And that's why I wrote that article, because I was quoting that saying that, you know, all great election victories contain the seeds of eventual defeat, which I have in the past applied to Tony Blair, because, I mean, in many ways, Tony Blair's success sort of foretold his eventual fall. And with Boris Johnson, that seems to have happened rather faster.
And before we go a bit further into Boris Johnson, what were you identifying with Tony Blair's astonishing victory, landslide victory in 1997? What do you think we should have seen then that would have eventually led, you know, all of that decade later to his leaving?
Well, I mean, because it was such a success, it was achieved by appealing to parts of the electorate that, you know, no previous Labour leader had ever appealed to. So it was his Toryism, in a sense, his ability to appeal right across the spectrum, which was related to the fact that he wanted to ally himself with a Republican president in the US, because he didn't want to allow any space to his right for the Conservatives to occupy, and of course that was what did for him in the end, was sticking close to George W. Bush, and means that, you know, Iraq will forever be attached to his historical record.
So back to Boris Johnson. Psychologically, we're very influenced, of course, by the people around us, and that's why, you know, we can change a lot. We can often be different people in a different group. How do you think Boris Johnson's childhood, his schooling, his early career led, in effect, to the way that government is being run at the moment?
Well, Boris Johnson is a fascinating psychological specimen, isn't he? I mean, Tony Blair is too. I mean, all these political leaders are. I mean, you don't get to be Prime Minister without being exceptional in some ways. But the ways in which Boris Johnson is exceptional are exceptionally exceptional. There's this theory about how the loss of a parent, a father figure, in Boris Johnson's case, his mother, at an early age, can instill sort of supernormal ambition. I mean, it happened to Tony Blair. His father suffered a stroke when Tony Blair was 11. And I think, you know, Tony Blair is quite explicit about how that imposed an obligation on him to to succeed on his father's behalf.
And David Cameron has actually also spoken of a similar thing with his father's illness.
That's right. And it happened. I mean, John Major's father's business went bust. His father was suddenly reduced. I can't remember how old John Major was, but at his sort of young teenage years, his father was reduced from a successful figure to a failure, and they had to move to somewhere poorer. And of course, Boris Johnson's mother had a nervous breakdown when he was 9 or 10, and I think he was very close to his mother. And I think that, I mean, without getting into you know, pop psychotherapy, you can see how that would have had a formative influence on the young Johnson.
And there have also been comments made by teachers at Eton about how Boris Johnson didn't feel that the rules applied to him. And that has certainly become one of those narratives. I mean, we tell stories to ourselves to make sense of the world, don't we? And yeah, that can, in the end, start to become a little bit difficult for political parties when they're trying to tell a different story. They're trying to shape a different narrative, but the public has already created its own narrative. And I guess Partygate is one of those moments where the narrative seems to be the Conservatives don't play by the rules, they don't play fair, or they don't care.
Yeah, I mean, that's the extraordinary thing, is, you know, that Boris Johnson succeeded by pushing the boundaries and by not observing the rules. And yet he's also been brought down by the lockdown rule breaking. You know, as Prime Minister, he made the rules himself. He made the laws and then seems to have blithely ignored them, or thought that, you know, he was making laws for other people, not for himself, and therefore echoing the comments of his Eton housemaster. You know, he really doesn't seem to think that the rules that apply to everybody else apply to him, which is why that phrase, you know, one rule for them and a different rule for the rest of us, is so damaging to his government.
Yes, because it resonates. You don't even have to explain it. It's like a joke where you don't have to explain the punchline. People just get it. I was also thinking about some of the other relationships in his life, and arguably one of the key ones politically was with Dominic Cummings. Boris Johnson appears to inspire quite fierce loyalty from people until he doesn't, and then, you know, all bets are off. And you have written about how the interview in the Rose Garden that Dominic Cummings gave after his infamous trip to Barnard Castle, you've identified that as the moment in a way that broke that relationship. So how important was it that that relationship existed in the sort of early, well, let's say during the leadership bid and then those early months of Boris Johnson being Prime Minister? And what impact has that unravelling had on where we are right now? Was he the stabilisers on this infamous shopping trolley that he...
Dominic Cummings, the stabiliser? No,
that's the scary thing.
The thing about Dominic Cummings is he had a very bad influence on Boris Johnson, I think, in the sense that he egged him on to develop that sort of rule-breaking persona, because, you know, it was Dominic Cummings' idea that, you know, if Boris Johnson just threw his weight around and threatened to break laws and parliamentary conventions, he could get Brexit done. And it turned out that worked, actually, because it was Boris Johnson's determination to get Brexit done. And his, you know, he wanted to leave without even doing a deal. Well, he wanted to be able to threaten to leave without doing a deal with the EU. And that so alarmed the House of Commons that, you know, in the end, the Labour Party broke and some Labour MPs started to come over to the government side. And that's what allowed Boris Johnson to have his election. And that's what gave him the got Brexit done. And it was Dominic Cummings's sort of destructive chaos approach to politics, which, you know, for some time, they, you know, the two of them, I think, were very close and reinforced each other in this rule-breaking persona that Boris Johnson had developed. And it was only after Barnard Castle, as I say, that things started to go wrong.
And what do you think that was about then? Was there some sense in which Dominic Cummings thought he'd been hung out to dry, given, as you say, that they were this sort of Batman and Robin destructive duo together, but then suddenly he ends up having to apologise sitting on that behind that table in the Rose Garden?
As ever, you know, Boris Johnson becomes completely ambiguous and hard to read at moments like that, because he supported Dominic Cummings. He didn't hang him out to dry. He allowed him to hold that news conference, which was probably a bad idea from Dominic Cummings' point of view. We've seen the same pattern with Matt Hancock. I mean, when he was on the front page of The Sun, Boris Johnson didn't sack him immediately. He allowed him to reach his own conclusions. I mean, it took a few days, and you know, journalists were saying to the Prime Minister, "Why haven't you sacked him?" And, you know, but Boris would just give sort of non-committal answers. But the relationship, you know, was over. It just takes time for the other person to realise it.
And in which case, that's why he has probably felt so wounded, because he didn't realise that it had ended. He'd been ghosted and didn't quite know the ending had happened.
Dominic Cummings didn't realise. No, that, yeah. I think that's right, because I think Boris Johnson had realised that Dominic was a liability, but he didn't want to say so to his face. He just wanted because I think he does it. He doesn't like confrontation. Nobody does. But actually, for a politician at the top of the tree, confrontations are generally a bad idea. And you want to allow the other person to just sort of reach their own conclusions in their own time.
But isn't that extraordinary? Because that's exactly what people used to say about Tony Blair when he was in office, that you could walk into a room with him and have a conversation and leave thinking, my goodness, he completely agrees with everything I think, and then discover the following day that in fact something has been announced which completely contradicts your experience. And I think people have also said a similar thing about Bill Clinton, that they make you feel completely loved and heard and seen until you realise that in fact that's completely the opposite. And that's quite a skillful, quite an incredible trait to have, but it really damages your relationships with other people, because you can't trust them. And we get back to this narrative around trust, the Chris Pincher story. Do you think that's another example of Boris Johnson and his attachments to people, and how hard to read they are? He'll be loyal until he's not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he thought he needed Chris Pincher to get him out of a hole, because Chris Pincher was part of that sort of shadow whipping operation that organised Tory MPs behind Boris when he was facing the vote of confidence. So he overlooked what he presumably knew about Chris Pincher. And of course, he's like Baldrick. He just denies everything. So when people said, "Well, you knew about Pincher's people's doubts about Pincher," he just says, "No, of course I didn't." And that's what gets Boris into trouble, because that again is a psychological trait. I mean, that ability to allow people to think that you're on their side is absolutely essential to a politician on the way up. But of course, you know, once people start to fall away, it becomes a liability. I mean, what's extraordinary about Tony Blair is that he kept it up for so long.
John Rentall, thank you very much indeed for being my guest.
Absolutely. Thank you, Lucy.